This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC-46012, The Mark of the Assassin, by Daniel Silva. Copyright 1998, by Daniel Silva. Read by Ted Stoddard. This book contains 465 pages on 9 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress annotation. An Arab terrorist shoots down a commercial plane near Long Island, conveniently advancing a business scheme to manufacture anti-missile systems. But CIA agent Michael Osborne takes serious personal risks to try to learn who was really responsible for the attack. Some violence, some descriptions of sex, and some strong language. Bestseller, 1998. From the book jacket. Daniel Silva's first novel, The Unlikely Spy, which Richard Bernstein of the New York Times called briskly suspenseful, tightly constructed, reminiscent of John le Carré's classic The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, proved itself to be one of the most auspicious thriller debuts in years. It was translated into over a dozen languages and went on to become a major international bestseller. Now, with The Mark of the Assassin, Silva firmly takes his place among the most compelling writers of his generation. It is an unputdownable tale of power, politics, and intrigue. When Michael Osborne of the CIA is called in to investigate the terrorist bombing of an airliner off the coast of Long Island, there is one relevant clue that drives him. A body found in the water near the crash site with 3 bullet holes in its face. Osborne recognizes the deadly markings as the work of a world-class assassin, a man whose very existence has never been proven because the only people ever to have seen him became his victims. And among those victims was a young woman Osborne loved years before. As Osborne gets closer and closer to the assassin's trail, his personal obsessions threaten to consume not only the investigation, but his marriage and family life as well. When the frightening identity of the assassin's employers becomes clear, Osborne puts himself and his loved ones in the sights of the most fearsome man on earth. With breathtaking plot twists, complex characters, and a villain who is among the most ruthless diabolical creations in modern thriller fiction, The Mark of the Assassin is a razor-sharp suspense masterpiece from one of the most exciting new authors at work today. About the author. Daniel Silva's first novel, The Unlikely Spy, was a New York Times and international bestseller and was sold as a major motion picture to 20th Century Fox. A former journalist and television producer, Silva has covered everything from Washington politics to the conflicts in the Middle East. He lived and worked in Cairo, where some of The Mark of the Assassin is set. He now lives in Washington, D.C., with his wife, NBC Today show correspondent Jamie Gangel, and their 2 children. He is currently at work on a new novel. For Esther Newberg, my literary agent and friend. And, as always, for my wife, Jamie, who makes everything possible. And my children, Lily and Nicholas. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. The Creed of the Central Intelligence Agency, taken from the Book of John. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall piss you off. The Staff Version. Prologue. The Czech-Austrian Border, August 1968. The searchlight played across the flat, open field. They lay in a drainage ditch on the Czech side of the border. A man and woman and a teenage boy. Others had come this way on previous nights. Dissidents, reformers, anarchists, hoping to escape the Russians, who had invaded Czechoslovakia and crushed Alexander Dubček's experiment with freedom, already known as the Prague Spring. A few had made it. Most had been arrested. Dubček himself had been abducted and taken to the Soviet Union. According to the bristling rumor mill, some had been taken to a nearby potato patch and shot. The three people in the ditch were not worried about making it out. They had been ordered to come at that time and had been assured their passage to the West would go smoothly. They had no reason to doubt what they had been told, for all three were officers of the Soviet Committee for State Security, better known as the KGB. The man and the woman served in the first chief directorate of the KGB. Their orders were to infiltrate the dissident Czech and Russian communities in the West. The boy was assigned to Department 5, the assassins. The man crawled on his belly to the top of the ditch and peered into the night. He put his face down in the cool, damp grass as the light passed overhead. When darkness returned, he rose again and watched. A half moon hung low on the horizon, throwing off just enough light to see it all clearly. The guard tower, the silhouette of a border policeman, a second policeman walking along the gravel approach to the fence. The man checked the luminous dial of his watch. He turned around and whispered in Czech, "Stay here. I'll see if they're ready for us." He crawled over the top of the ditch and was gone. The woman looked at the boy. He was no more than 16 years old, and she had been sleepless with sexual fantasies about him since they had come to Czechoslovakia 3 weeks earlier. He was too pretty for a boy. Black hair, deep blue eyes, like a Siberian lake. His skin was pale, almost white. He had never been operational before tonight, yet he showed no signs of fear. He noticed she was looking at him. He stared back at her with an animal directness that made her shiver. The man returned 5 minutes later. "Hurry," he said. "Walk quickly and don't say a word." He reached down and pulled the woman out of the ditch. He offered a hand to the boy, who refused and climbed out himself. The border policeman met them at the fence. They walked 50 meters to the spot where the gash had been cut in the wire. The guard pulled back the flap, and one by one, the three KGB agents crossed into Austria. The control officers at Moscow Center had written the script for them. They were to proceed on foot to the nearest village and find an Austrian police officer. From past experience, they knew they would be taken to a detention center for other refugees from the East. Inevitably, they would undergo vigorous questioning from Austrian security agents to make certain they were not spies. Their Czech identities had taken months to manufacture. They were airtight. Within weeks, if all went according to plan, they would be released into the West and begin their assignments for the KGB. Department 5 had other plans for the boy. There was no security on the Austrian side of the border. They crossed an open field. The air was thick with the stink of manure and the chatter of crickets. The landscape darkened as the wet moon slipped behind a stray cloud. The lane was exactly where the control officers had said it would be. "When you reach the road, head south," they had said. "Village will be there 2 miles away." The lane was pitted and narrow, barely wide enough for a horse-drawn cart, rising and falling over the gentle landscape. They walked quickly, the man and woman leading, the boy a few feet behind. Within a half hour, the horizon glowed with lamplight. A few moments later, a church steeple floated into view above a low hill. It was then that the boy reached inside his coat, withdrew a silenced pistol, and shot the man in the back of the head. The woman turned quickly, eyes wide with terror. The boy's arm swung up, and he shot her rapidly 3 times in the face. October. Chapter 1. Off Long Island, New York. They made the attempt on the third night. The first night was no good. Heavy cloud cover, intermittent rain, wind-blown squalls. The second night was clear, with a good moon, but a bitter northwest wind made the seas too rough. Even the ocean-going motor yacht was buffeted about. It would be hell in the Boston Whaler. They needed a calm sea to carry it off from the whaler, so they motored farther out and spent a seasick night waiting. That morning, the third morning, the marine forecast was promising. Diminishing winds, gentle seas, a slow-moving front with clear weather behind it. The forecast proved accurate. The third night was perfect. His real name was Hassan Mahmoud, but he had always found it rather dull for an Islamic freedom fighter, so he had granted himself a more venturous nom de guerre, Abu Jihad. He was born in Gaza and raised by an uncle in a squalid refugee camp near Gaza City. His politics were forged by the stones and fire of the Intifada. He joined Hamas, fought Israelis in the streets, buried two brothers and more friends than he could remember. He was wounded once himself, his right shoulder shattered by an Israeli army bullet. The doctors said he would never regain full use of the arm. Hassan Mahmoud, alias Abu Jihad, learned to throw stones with his left. The yacht was 110 feet in length, with six staterooms, a large salon, and an aft deck large enough to accommodate a cocktail party of 60 people. The bridge was state-of-the-art, with satellite navigation and communication systems. It was designed for a crew of three, but two good men could handle it easily. They had set out from the tiny port of Gustavia on the Caribbean island of San Barthélemy 8 days earlier and had taken their time moving up the east coast of the United States. They had stayed well outside American territorial waters, but still they had felt the gentle touch of U.S. surveillance along the way. The P-3 Orion aircraft that passed overhead each day, the U.S. Coast Guard cutters slicing through the open sea in the distance. They had prepared a cover story in the event they were challenged. The vessel was registered in the name of a wealthy French investor, and they were moving it from the Caribbean to Nova Scotia. There, the Frenchman would board the yacht, along with a party of 12, for a month-long Caribbean cruise. There was no Frenchman. An officer in a friendly intelligence service had created him, and there most certainly was no party of 12. As for Canada, they had no intention of going anywhere near it. That night, they operated under blackout conditions. It was clear and quite cold. The bright half-moon provided enough light to move about the decks easily. The engine was shut down, just in case an infrared-equipped satellite or aircraft passed overhead. The yacht rocked gently on the flat sea. Hassan Mahmoud smoked nervously in the darkened salon. He wore jeans, Nike running shoes, and a fleece pullover from L.L. Bean. He looked up at the other man. They had been together 10 days, but his companion had spoken only when necessary. One warm night, off the coast of Georgia, Mahmoud tried to engage him in conversation. The man simply grunted and walked to his stateroom. On those rare occasions when he did communicate verbally, he spoke in the precise, accentless Arabic of someone who has studied the language diligently, but not mastered its subtleties. When Mahmoud asked his name, the man ran his hand over his short black hair, pulled at his nose, and said if names were necessary, he should be called Yasim. He most definitely was not a Yasim. Mahmoud had traveled well for a boy from the camps of Gaza. The trade of terror made that a necessity. He had been to Rome, and he had been to London. He had stayed many months in Athens and hidden with a Palestinian cell in Madrid for an entire winter. The man who wished to be called Yasim and spoke with a strange accent was no Arab. Mahmoud watching him now, tried to assign geography and ethnicity to the cocktail of strange features possessed by his silent accomplice. He looked at the hair, nearly black and shot with gray at the temples. The eyes were a penetrating blue, the skin so pale as to be nearly white. The nose was long and narrow. A woman's nose, he thought. The lips full and sensuous. The cheekbones wide. Maybe Greek, he thought. Maybe Italian or Spanish. Maybe a Turk or a Kurd. For a mad instant, he thought he might be an Israeli. Mahmoud watched as a man who wished to be called Yasim disappeared down the companionway and went below decks. He returned 2 minutes later, carrying a long, slender object. Mahmoud knew just one word for it. Stinger. Yasim, when he spoke, treated Mahmoud as though he knew nothing of stingers. Mahmoud knew them quite well, however. He knew the shoulder-launched version was 5 feet long and weighed precisely 34.5 pounds. He knew it possessed heat-seeking, passive infrared, and ultraviolet guidance systems. He knew its effective range was about 3 miles. He had never actually fired one. The things were too precious and too costly to waste on a test firing. But he had drilled for dozens of hours and knew exactly what to expect. It's already been preset to seek out a large four-engine aircraft, Yasim was saying. The warhead has been set to penetrate the target before exploding. Mahmoud nodded and said nothing. Point the missile at the target, he said patiently in his accentless Arabic. When the guidance system has acquired its target and locked on, you will hear the tone in your ear. When you hear the tone, fire the missile. Mahmoud tapped out another Marlboro and offered one to Yasim, who waved his hand and went on with his lecture. When the missile is away, simply lay the empty launch tube in the whaler and return to the yacht. I was told to throw the launch tube into the water, Mahmoud said. And I'm telling you to bring it back here. When the airliner goes down, the Americans will scan the seafloor with sonar. There's a damned good chance they'll find your launch tube. So bring it back with you. We'll dispose of it farther out. Mahmoud nodded. He had been told to do it differently, but the explanation for the change in plans was reasonable. For 20 minutes, they said nothing. Mahmoud toyed with the grip stock of the Stinger. Yasim poured coffee and drank it on the aft deck in the cold night air. Then Yasim went to the bridge to listen to the radio. Mahmoud, still sitting in the salon, could hear the crisp commands of the air traffic controllers at JFK International Airport. Two smaller boats were secured to the stern of the motor yacht, a Zodiac and a 20-foot Boston whaler Dauntless. Mahmoud clambered down to the swim step, drew the whaler closer to the yacht, and stepped over the rail into the forward seating area. Yasim followed him down the ladder and handed over the Stinger. The whaler had a dual console, split by a passage connecting the forward and aft seating areas. Mahmoud laid the Stinger on the aft deck, sat in the cockpit, and fired the engine. Yasim untied the whaler, tossed the line onto the deck, and pushed the smaller craft away with a quick movement of his foot. Mahmoud opened the throttle, and the whaler sliced toward the shore of Long Island. Transatlantic Airlines Flight 002 departs JFK International Airport each evening at 7 and arrives the following morning in London at 6:55. Captain Frank Hollings had made the trip more times than he cared to remember, many times in the same Boeing 747 he would fly that night, N75639. The aircraft was the 150th to roll off Boeing's 747 assembly line in Renton, Washington, and it had experienced few problems during its 3 decades in the air. The forecast called for clear weather most of the way and a rainy approach to Heathrow. Hollings expected a smooth flight. At 6:55, the first flight attendant informed Captain Hollings that all passengers were on board. At precisely 7, he he ordered the cabin doors closed, and Transatlantic Flight 002 pushed back from the gate. Mary North taught English at Bayshore High School on Long Island and served as faculty advisor to the drama club. It had sounded like a good idea at the time, escorting club members to London for 5 days of theater and sightseeing. It had taken more effort than she could have imagined. Endless bake sales, car washes, and raffles. Mary had paid her own way, but it meant leaving her husband and two children behind. John taught chemistry at Bayshore, and jetting to London for a few days of theater was beyond their budget. The students were acting like animals. It had started in the van on the way to Kennedy, the shouting, the screaming, the rap music, and Nirvana blasting from headphones. Her own children were 4 and 6, and each night she prayed they would never reach puberty. Now the students were throwing popcorn at each other and making suggestive comments about the flight attendants. Mary North closed her eyes. Maybe they'll get tired soon, she thought. Maybe they'll sleep. A popcorn kernel bounced off her nose. She thought, maybe you've truly lost your mind, Mary. As Flight 002 taxied toward the end of the runway, Hassan Mahmoud was aboard the Dauntless, racing toward the western tip of Fire Island, the slender barrier island on the southern shore of Long Island. The trip from the motor yacht had been uneventful. The low moon shone in the eastern sky, allowing him to navigate with no running lights. Ahead of him, the borough of Queens glowed pale yellow on the horizon. Conditions were perfect. Clear skies, calm seas, scarcely a wind. Mahmoud checked the depthometer and shut down the engine. The Dauntless glided to a stop. In the distance, he could hear the grumble of a freighter leaving New York Harbor. He switched on the radio and tuned it to the proper frequency. 5 minutes later, Mahmoud heard the air traffic controller give Transatlantic Flight 002 final clearance for takeoff. He picked up the Stinger and switched on its fire and guidance systems. Then he hoisted it onto his shoulder and peered through the sighting mechanism into the night sky. Mahmoud heard the jetliner before he could actually see it. 10 seconds later, he picked up the 747's navigation lights and tracked it across the black sky. Then the tone sounded in his ear, alerting him that the Stinger had acquired a target. The whaler rolled violently as the Stinger's solid rocket fuel ignited and the missile roared from the launch tube. The Americans like to refer to their precious Stinger as a fire-and-forget weapon, his trainer had told him during one of their sessions. The trainer was an Afghan who had lost an eye and a hand killing Russians. Fire and forget, Mahmoud thought. Fire and forget. Simple as that. The launch tube, now empty, was considerably lighter than before. He dropped it onto the deck, as Yasim had instructed him to do. Then he fired the whaler's engine and raced away from the coast, taking just one glance over his shoulder to watch the Stinger streaking at supersonic speed across the black canvas of the night. Captain Frank Hollings had flown B-52s over North Vietnam, and he had seen surface-to-air missiles before. For a brief instant, he permitted himself to believe it might be something else, a small plane ablaze, a meteor, stray fireworks. Then, as the missile raced relentlessly toward them at lightning speed, he realized it could be nothing else. The nightmare scenario had come true. Holy Mother of God, he murmured. He turned toward his co-pilot and opened his mouth to speak. The aircraft shuddered violently. An instant later, it was ripped apart by a massive explosion, and fire rained down on the sea. When he heard the approach of the Dauntless, the man called Yasin quickly flashed a powerful signal lamp 3 times. The smaller vessel came into view. Mahmoud reduced power, and the Dauntless glided toward the stern of the yacht. Even in the weak light of the moon, he could see it on the boy's face, the crazed excitement, the fear, the rush. He could see it in the shining, deep brown Palestinian eyes, see it in the jittery hands fumbling over the controls of the Dauntless. Left to his own devices, Mahmoud would be up all night, and the next day too, reliving it, recounting every detail, explaining over and over how it felt the moment the plane burst into flames. Yasim detested ideologues, detested the way they all wore their suffering like armor and disguised their fear as valor. He distrusted anyone who would willingly lead a life such as this. He trusted only professionals. The Dauntless nudged against the stern of the yacht. The wind had picked up in the last few minutes. Gentle swells lapped against the sides of the boats. Yasim climbed down the ladder as Hassan Mahmoud shut down the engine and clambered into the forward seating area. He reached out a hand for Yasim to help him out of the boat. But Yasim simply drew a silenced 9mm Glock pistol from the waistband of his trousers and shot the Palestinian boy rapidly 3 times in the face. That night, he set the yacht on an easterly heading and engaged the automatic navigation systems. He lay awake in his stateroom. Even now, even after countless killings, he could not sleep the first night after an assassination. When he was making his escape, or still in public, he always managed to remain focused and operational cool. But at night, the demons came. At night, he saw the faces, one by one, like photographs in an album. First alive and vibrant, then contorted with the death mask or blown apart by his favorite method of killing, 3 bullets to the face. Then the guilt would come, and he would tell himself that he had not chosen this life. It had been chosen for him. At dawn, with the first gray light of morning leaking through his window, he finally slept. He rose at midday and went about the routine of preparing for his departure. He shaved and showered, then dressed and packed the rest of his clothing into a small leather grip. He made coffee and drank it while watching CNN on the yacht's superb satellite television system. Such a pity. The grieving relatives at Kennedy and Heathrow, the vigil at a high school somewhere on Long Island, the reporters wildly speculating about the cause of the crash. He walked through the yacht room by room one last time to make certain he had left no trace of his presence. He checked the explosive charges. At 6 p.m., the precise time he had been ordered, he retrieved a small black object from a cabinet in the galley. It was no larger than a cigar box and looked vaguely like a radio. He carried it outside onto the aft deck and pressed a single button. There was no sound, but he knew the message had been sent in a coded microburst. Even if the American NSA intercepted it, it would be meaningless gibberish. The yacht motored eastward for 2 more hours. It was now 8 p.m. He set each of the charges and then slipped on a canvas vest with a heavy metal clamp on the front. There was more wind tonight. It was colder, and there were high clouds. The Zodiac, cleated at the stern, rose and fell rhythmically with the 3-foot swells. He climbed into the craft, untied it, and pulled the starter cord. The engine came to life on the 3rd pull. He turned away from the yacht and opened the throttle. He heard the helicopter 20 minutes later. He shut down the Zodiac's engine and shone a signal lamp into the sky. The helicopter hovered overhead, the night filled with the thump of its rotors. The cable fell from its belly. He attached it to his vest and pulled hard on it 2 times to signal that he was ready. A moment later, he rose gently from the Zodiac. He heard explosions in the distance. He turned his head in time to see the large motor yacht being lifted out of the water by the force of the blasts. Then it began its slow descent toward the bottom of the Atlantic. Chapter 2, San Francisco. President James Beckwith was notified of the tragedy while vacationing at his home in San Francisco. He had hoped for a few days of rest, a quiet afternoon in his study overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge, a relaxing dinner party with old friends and political supporters in Marin. Most of all, a day of sailing aboard his prized 38-foot ketch, Democracy, even if it meant being pursued by a pack of White House pool reporters and cameramen across the waters of San Francisco Bay. The day sales on democracy always provided the kind of news pictures his handlers and political advisors liked best. The president, fit and youthful despite his 69 years, still able to handle the boat with only Anne aboard, the tanned face, the lean body moving easily about the deck, the smart European-style sunglasses beneath the brim of his Air Force One cap. The private office in Beckwith's large home in the Marina District reflected his taste and image to perfection. Polished, comfortable, traditional, yet with enough modern touches to convey that he was firmly in touch with today's world. The desk was glass, tinted slightly gray, his personal computer black. He took pride in knowing as much about computers, if not more, than most of his youthful staff. He picked up the receiver of his black telephone and pressed a single button. A White House operator came onto the line. "Yes, Mr. President?" "Unless the chief of staff telephones, hold all my calls for now, Grace. I'd like some time to myself." "Of course, Mr. President." He heard the line go dead. He replaced the receiver and walked to the window. It was a remarkable view, despite the dense, bulletproof glass inflicted by the Secret Service. The sun had dropped low into the western sky, painting the city's soft watercolor shades of purple and orange. The evening's fog was creeping through the Golden Gate. Below him, colorful kites floated over the bay shore. The view worked its magic. He had forgotten how long he had been standing there, watching the silent city, the white-capped waters of the bay, the brown hills of Marin in the distance. The last light of the afternoon retreated, and after a few minutes, his own reflection stared back at him in the glass. Beckwith disliked the word patrician, but even he had to admit it was an accurate description of his appearance and bearing. His advisors joked that if God had created the perfect political candidate, it would have been James Beckwith. He stood out in any room he entered. He was well over 6 feet tall, with a full head of shimmering hair that had turned gray-white by the time he was 40. There was a strength about him, a lingering physical agility from his days as a star football and baseball player at Stanford. The eyes were pale blue and turned down at the corners, the features of his face narrow and restrained, the smile careful but confident. His skin was permanently tanned from countless hours aboard Democracy. When Beckwith assumed the presidency 4 years earlier, he had made one promise to himself. He would not allow the office to consume him the way it had consumed so many of his predecessors. He ran 30 minutes each day on the treadmill and spent another 30 minutes lifting weights in the White House gym. Other men had grown haggard in the office. James Beckwith had lowered his weight and added an inch of muscle to his chest. Beckwith had not sought out politics. Politics had come to him. He was a top prosecutor in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office when he caught the eye of the state's Republican elite. With Anne and their three children at his side, Beckwith easily won every race he entered. His rise had seemed effortless, as if he were preordained to greatness. California elected him Attorney General, then Lieutenant Governor. It sent him to the U.S. Senate for 2 terms, and then brought him back to Sacramento for a term as governor, the final preparation for his ascent to the White House. Throughout his political career, the professionals surrounding him had crafted a careful image. James Beckwith was a common-sense conservative. James Beckwith was a man the country could trust. James Beckwith could get things done. He was exactly the kind of man the Republican Party was looking for, a moderate with a pleasing face, a presentable counterbalance to the hard-line conservatives in Congress. After 8 years of Democratic control of the White House, the country had been in the mood for change. The country chose Beckwith. Now, 4 years later, the country wasn't sure it still wanted him. He turned from the window, walked to his desk, and poured himself a cup of coffee from a chrome-colored insulated carafe. Beckwith believed that from all adversity, good things come. The downing of an American jetliner off Long Island was an egregious act of international terrorism, a savage and cowardly deed that could not go unanswered. The electorate soon would be told what Beckwith already knew. Transatlantic Flight 002 had been brought down by a Stinger missile, apparently launched from a small craft offshore. The American people would be frightened, and if history were a guide, they would turn to him for comfort and assurance. James Beckwith detested the business of politics, but he was savvy enough to realize that the terrorists had handed him a golden opportunity. For the past year, his approval rating had hovered below 50%, death for an incumbent president. His acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention had been flat and lifeless. The Washington Press Corps had branded his vision for a second term warmed over first term. Some of its elite members had begun writing his political obituary. But just 1 month before the election, he trailed his opponent, Democratic Senator Andrew Sterling of Nebraska, by 3 to 5 points in most national polls. The electoral map looked different, though. Beckwith had conceded New York, New England, and the industrial Midwest to Sterling. His support remained solid in the South, the crucial states of Florida and Texas and California, the Mountain West. If Beckwith could capture them all, he could win. If any one of them fell to Sterling, the election was lost. He knew the downing of Flight 002 would change everything. The campaign would freeze. Beckwith would cancel a swing through Tennessee and Kentucky to return to Washington to deal with the crisis. If he managed it well, his approval ratings would rise and he would close the gap. And he could do it all from the comfort and security of the White House, not racing around the country in Air Force One or some godforsaken campaign bus, shaking hands with old people, making the same goddamn speech over and over again. Great men are not born great, he told himself. Great men become great because they seize opportunity. He carried his coffee back to the window. He thought, but do I really want a second term? Unlike most of his predecessors, he had given that question serious consideration. He wondered whether he had the endurance for one last national campaign. The endless fundraising, the microscopic scrutiny of his record, the constant travel. He and Anne had come to detest living in Washington. He had never been accepted by the city's ruling elite, its rich journalists, lawyers, and lobbyists, and the executive mansion had become more like a prison than a home. But to leave office after one term was unacceptable. To lose re-election to a second-term senator from Nebraska and leave Washington in defeat? Beckwith shuddered at the thought. They would be coming for him soon. There was a private bathroom just off his study. An aide had left his clothes on a hook on the back of the door. The president went inside and cast his eyes over the clothing. He knew the outfit had been selected personally by his chief of staff and longtime friend, Paul Vandenberg. Paul saw to the details. Paul saw to everything. Beckwith would be lost without him. Sometimes, even Beckwith was embarrassed by the extent to which Paul Vandenberg ran his affairs. The media routinely referred to him as the Prime Minister, or the power behind the throne. Beckwith, ever conscious of his image in history, worried he would be written off as a pawn of Paul Vandenberg. But Vandenberg had given Beckwith his word. He would never portray himself in that manner. The president trusted him. Paul Vandenberg knew how to keep secrets. He believed in the quiet exercise of power. He was intensely private, kept a low profile, and leaked to reporters only when it was absolutely necessary. He reluctantly appeared on the Sunday morning talk shows, but only when the White House press secretary begged. Beckwith thought he was a horrible guest. The confidence and brilliance he displayed in private planning and policy meetings evaporated once the red light of the television camera came on. He removed his faded jeans and cotton pullover and dressed in the clothes Paul had chosen for him. Gray woolen trousers, blue button-down shirt, lightweight crewneck sweater, blue blazer. Dignified, yet comforting. His national security staff was meeting in 10 minutes in the dining room downstairs. There would be no video cameras, just a White House still photographer who would capture the moment for the press and for history. James Beckwith, confronting the most important crisis of his presidency. James Beckwith, casting aside his re-election campaign to deal with the responsibilities of his office, James Beckwith, leader. He looked at his reflection in the mirror one last time. Great men are not born great. Great men become great because they seize opportunity. Chapter 3, Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Osborne had been dreading this moment all week. She turned her silver Mercedes into the parking lot at Georgetown University Medical Center and found a space not far from the entrance. She looked at the dashboard clock. It was 4:30. She was 15 minutes early. She shut off the engine. A tropical storm had moved up from the Gulf of Mexico and settled over the city. Heavy rains fell all afternoon. Gusty winds uprooted trees all across northwest Washington, shut down National Airport, and drove the tourists from the monuments and museums along the mall. Rain drummed on the roof and ran in rivers down the windshield. After a moment, the rest of the world vanished behind a blurry curtain of water. Elizabeth liked the sensation of being able to see nothing else around her. She closed her eyes. She liked to fantasize about changing her life, about slowing down, about leaving Washington and settling somewhere slow and quiet with Michael. She knew it was a silly, unrealistic dream. Elizabeth Osborne was one of Washington's most respected lawyers. Her husband, while professing to be an international business consultant, was a senior officer at the Central Intelligence Agency. Her cellular phone rang softly. She picked up the handset, eyes still closed, and said, "Yes, Max." Max Lewis was her 26-year-old executive secretary. The previous night, sitting alone in her bedroom with a glass of wine and a stack of legal briefs, Elizabeth had realized she spoke to Max more than anyone else in the world. This depressed her greatly. "How did you know it was me?" he asked. "Because you and my husband are the only people who have this number, and I knew it couldn't be him." "You sound disappointed." "No, just a little tired." "What's up?" "David Carpenter's on the line from Miami." "Tell Mr. Carpenter I'll call him as soon as I get home. It's been my experience that conversations with David Carpenter should rarely be conducted on cellular telephones." "He says it's urgent." "It usually is." "What time should I tell him to expect your call?" "About 7 o'clock. But it may slip a little bit, depending on how things go here." Braxton's secretary telephoned. Samuel Braxton was the managing partner at Braxton, Allworth & Kettleman, and the firm's biggest rainmaker. He had served 2 Republican administrations, once as Deputy White House Chief of Staff and once as Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, and was on the short list to be Secretary of State if Beckwith managed to win a second term. He viewed Elizabeth with suspicion because he didn't like her politics. Her father was Douglas Cannon, a liberal Democrat from New York who served 4 terms in the Senate, and she had twice left the firm to work for Democratic senators. Braxton routinely referred to her as our in-house lefty. At meetings, when working his way around the table on an issue, he frequently managed to break up the room by turning to Elizabeth and saying, "And now, with a view from the ACLU, Elizabeth Cannon Osborne." There was a more serious side to her conflict with Samuel Braxton. He had fought to prevent her from making partner, and had relented only when the other partners convinced him he would be setting the firm up for a gender discrimination lawsuit. Now, 3 years later, their relationship had settled into an uneasy truce. Braxton generally treated her with respect and made a genuine effort to consult her on all major decisions concerning the future and direction of the firm. He regularly invited her to social functions, and last year at the White House Christmas party, he referred to her as one of our real stars when introducing her to Chief of Staff Paul Vandenberg. "What does Lord Braxton desire, Max?" Max laughed. She would trust him with her life. It was mutual. 6 months earlier, Max had told her something he had told no one else. He was HIV positive. "The Lord would like you to attend a dinner party Thursday evening." "Is it being held at the manor?" "No, One of his big clients is throwing it. The Lord's secretary made it sound as if attendance was not optional. Who's the client? Mitchell Elliott. Mitchell Elliott of Alatron Defense Systems? He's the one. Where's the party? At Elliott's home in Colorama. California Street, to be precise. You have a pen handy? Elizabeth fished a pen and her calendar from her briefcase and jotted down the address as Max read it to her. What time? 7:30. Am I allowed to bring a date? Spouses are permitted. Elizabeth, you're going to be late for your appointment. She glanced at the dashboard clock. Oh, shit. Anything else? Nothing that can't hold till morning. Where am I going tomorrow? Chicago. I put the tickets in the outside flap of your briefcase. She pulled open the flap and saw the American Airlines first-class ticket jacket. I'd be lost without you, Max.
I know.
You didn't hear from Michael, did you?
Not a peep.
I'll call you from the plane tomorrow morning. Great, he said. And good luck, Elizabeth. I'll be thinking about you. She severed the connection and punched in the speed dial code for Michael's car phone. The phone rang 5 times before a recorded voice announced that the customer was not available at this time. Elizabeth angrily snapped the receiver back into its cradle. She sat very still for a moment, listening to the rattle of the rain. She whispered, Michael Osborne, if you don't drive into this parking lot in the next 5 minutes, so help me God, I'll... She waited 5 minutes. Then she struggled into her raincoat and stepped outside the warmth of the car into the storm. She threw up her umbrella and started across the parking lot, but the wind gusted and ripped it from her grasp. She watched it for a moment, tumbling toward Reservoir Road. Something about it made her laugh helplessly. She clutched her raincoat tightly against her throat and hurried across the parking lot through the rain. The doctor is running a few minutes behind schedule. The receptionist smiled, as though it was the most interesting thing she'd said all day. Elizabeth went inside, removed her wet raincoat, and sat down. She was the last patient of the afternoon, and, thankfully, she was alone. The last thing she wanted now was to make idle conversation with another woman suffering from the same problem. Rain pattered against the window overlooking the parking lot. She turned and peered out. A line of trees shed leaves to the onslaught of the wind. She looked for Michael's Jaguar, but saw no sign of it. She reached in her bag and removed one of her pocket cellular telephones. She carried 2 with her at all times to make certain she could conduct 2 conversations at once, and punched in Michael's number. Again, there was no answer. She wanted to phone his office, but if he was still at Langley, he would never make it in time anyway. She stood up and slowly paced the room. It was at times like these that Elizabeth Osborne detested the fact that she was married to a spy. Michael hated it when she called him a spy. He patiently explained he was a case officer, not a spy. She thought it was a silly term for what Michael did. It sounds as if you're some kind of counselor or social worker, Elizabeth had said the night Michael tried to explain his work to her for the first time. He smiled his careful smile and replied, Well, that's not very far from the truth. She had fallen in love with Michael before she learned he worked for the CIA. A friend had invited her sailing on the Chesapeake, and Michael had been invited too. It was a sweltering day in late July, with very little wind. As the boat drifted over the still water, Elizabeth and Michael lay in the shade of the limp sails, drinking icy beer and talking. Unlike most men in Washington, he spoke little about his work. He said he was an international business consultant. He had lived in London for a number of years, and he had just transferred to the firm's Washington office. That night, they ate crab cakes and drank cold white wine at a small waterfront restaurant in Annapolis. She found herself staring at him throughout the meal. He was simply the most beautiful man she had ever seen. The day of sailing had changed him. The sun had tanned his skin and left streaks of gold in his dark hair. His eyes were deep green, flecked with yellow, like wild summer grass. He had a long, straight nose, and several times she had to restrain herself from reaching out and touching his perfect lips. She thought he was rather exotic-looking, like an Italian or a Turk or a Spaniard. He followed her back into the city that night along Route 50, and she took him home to her bed. She was 34 years old and had almost given up on the idea of marriage. But that night, taking him inside her body for the first time, she fell desperately and hopelessly in love with a man who she had met just 8 hours earlier and about whom she knew next to nothing. He told her 2 months later, during a long weekend alone at her father's summer home on Shelter Island. It was late September. The days were warm, but at night, when the wind came up, there was a bite of autumn in the air. After dinner, they put on sweaters and long pants and drank coffee in Adirondack chairs on the beach. "I need to talk to you about my work," he said, without warning. And even in the dying twilight, she could see his face had gone suddenly serious. His work had been troubling her for weeks. She found it odd that he never discussed it unless she asked him. She was also troubled by the fact that he never called her during the day and never asked her to lunch. When she rang him at the office, a woman answered the phone and dutifully took down the message, but it was a different woman each time. Sometimes it was hours before he returned her call. When he did, he could never speak for longer than a minute or two. "I'm not an international business consultant, and I've never been one," he began. "I work for the CIA. I had to deceive you until I felt I could trust you enough to tell you. You have to understand, Elizabeth, I didn't want to hurt you." She reached out and slapped him across the face. "You bastard!" she screamed, so loudly that a group of gulls standing on the beach broke into flight over the water. "You lying bastard! I'll drive you to the ferry in the morning. You can take the bus back into the city. I never want to see you again. Damn you, Michael Osborne!" She stayed on the beach until the cold drove her inside. The bedroom was dark. She let herself inside without knocking and found him lying on the bed in the darkness. She undressed silently and pressed her body to his. He tried to speak, but she covered his lips with her mouth and said, "Not now. No talking aloud." Afterward, she said, "I don't care who you are or what you do for a living." She brushed her mouth against his chest. "I love the person that's inside here. And I don't ever want to lose you." "I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner. I couldn't." "Is Michael Osborne your real name?" "Yes." "You've never killed anyone, have you?" "No. We only kill people in the movies." "Have you ever seen anyone killed?" "Yes." "Can you talk about it?" "No, not yet." "You'll never lie to me, will you, Michael?" "I'll never lie to you, but there will be things I won't be able to tell you. Can you live with that?" "I don't know yet, but promise me you'll never lie to me." "I'll never lie to you." She kissed his mouth. "Why did you become a spy?" "We don't call ourselves spies. We call ourselves case officers." "Fine. So why did you become a case officer?" He laughed his quiet, controlled laugh. "I have no idea." Her father thought she was a fool to marry a CIA officer. He had served on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, and while he detested sweeping generalizations in principle, he believed the nation's spies were the biggest collection of kooks and oddballs he had ever seen. With Michael, he made an exception. The two men spent a day sailing together on Gardner's Bay, and the senator gave his enthusiastic blessing to the union. There was much about Michael's work Elizabeth loathed: the long hours, the travel to dangerous places, the fact that she really didn't know exactly what he did all day. She knew most women would find a marriage like hers unacceptable. She liked to think she was stronger than most women, more self-possessed, more independent. But at times like these, she wished her husband had a normal job. The room was quiet except for a large television set that continuously played an infomercial hosted by a television anchor woman Elizabeth detested. She wanted something to read, but all the magazines dealt with raising children, not a pleasant subject for a childless woman of 40. She tried to change the channel to watch the news, but the television wouldn't change channels. She tried to turn down the volume, but the volume was preset. She thought, an airliner has just been shot down, and I'm trapped with this insipid blonde trying to sell me baby lotion. She went back to the window and looked for Michael's car one last time. It was foolish of her to expect him. One of the few things she knew about her husband's job was that it dealt with counterterrorism. She would be lucky if he even managed to come home tonight. The nurse appeared in the doorway. The doctor is ready for you, Mrs. Osborne. This way, please. Elizabeth picked up her briefcase and her raincoat and followed the nurse down a narrow hall. 40 minutes later, Elizabeth took the elevator down to the lobby and stepped outside onto a covered sidewalk. She turned up her collar and plunged into the drenching rain. The wind blew her hair across her face and tore at her raincoat. Elizabeth seemed not to notice. She was numb. The doctor's words ran through her head like an irritating melody that she could not drive from her thoughts. You're incapable of having a baby naturally. There's a problem with your tubes. In vitro fertilization might help. We'll never know unless we try. I'm very sorry, Elizabeth. A car nearly struck her in the fading light. Elizabeth seemed not to notice as the driver blared his horn and tore off. She wanted to scream. She wanted to cry. She wanted to be sick. She thought about making love to Michael. Their marriage had its minor flaws. Too much time apart, too many distractions from work. But in bed, they were perfect. Their lovemaking was familiar, yet exciting. She knew Michael's body, and he knew hers. They knew how to give each other pleasure. Elizabeth had always assumed that when she was ready to have a baby, it would happen as naturally and pleasantly as their lovemaking. She felt betrayed by her body. The Mercedes stood alone in the corner of the parking lot. She dug in her pocket for her keys. She pointed the remote at the car and pressed the button. The doors unlocked and the lights came on. She climbed quickly inside, closed the door, and locked it again. She tried to shove the key into the ignition, but her hands were shaking and the keys fell from her grasp to the floor. Reaching down for them, she bumped her head against the dashboard. Elizabeth Osborne believed in composure. In the courtroom, in the office, with Michael. She never let her emotions get the better of her, even when Sam Braxton made one of his wisecracks. But now, sitting alone in her car, her hair plastered to the side of her face, composure deserted her. Her body slowly fell forward until her head rested against the steering wheel. Then the tears came, and she sat in the car and wept. Chapter 4, Washington, D.C. 20 minutes later, a black White House sedan pulled to the curb in the section of the city known as Colorama. Black staff cars and limousines were not unusual in the neighborhood. Nestled in the wooded hills on the edge of Rock Creek Park, just north of Massachusetts Avenue, Colorama was home to some of the city's most powerful and influential residents. Mitchell Elliott detested eastern cities as a rule. He spent most of his time in Colorado Springs, or at his canyonside home in Los Angeles, near the headquarters of Alatron Defense Systems. But his $3 million mansion in Colorama helped make his frequent trips to Washington bearable. He had considered a large estate in the horse country of Virginia, but commuting into the city along Interstate 66 was a nightmare, and Mitchell Elliott didn't have time to waste. Colorama was 10 minutes from National Airport and Capitol Hill, and 5 minutes from the White House. It was 5 minutes before 7. Elliot relaxed in the second-floor library overlooking the garden. The wind hurled rain against the glass. It was cold for October, and one of his aides had made a fire in the large fireplace. Elliot paced slowly, sipping 30-year-old single malt scotch from a cut glass tumbler. He was a small man, just over 5.5 feet tall, who had learned long ago how to carry himself like a big man. He never allowed an opponent to stand over him. When someone entered his office, Elliot always remained seated, legs crossed, hands resting on the arms of his chair, as if the space were too small to contain his frame. Elliot was schooled in the art of warfare, and more importantly, in the art of deception. He believed in illusion, misdirection. He ran his company like an intelligence agency. It operated on the principle of need to know. Information was strictly compartmentalized. The head of one division knew little of what was taking place inside another division, only what the executive needed to know. Elliot rarely conducted meetings with all his senior officers present. He gave them orders face-to-face in private meetings, never in written memoranda. All meetings with Elliot were regarded as strictly confidential. Executives were forbidden to discuss them with other executives. Office gossip was a firing offense, and if one of his employees was telling tales out of school, Elliot would soon know about it. Their telephones were tapped, their electronic mail was read, and surveillance cameras and microphones covered every square inch of office space. Mitchell Elliot saw nothing wrong with this. He believed God had given him the right, indeed the responsibility, to take whatever steps were necessary to protect his company and his country. Elliot's belief in God pervaded everything he did. He believed the United States was God's chosen land, Americans his chosen people. He believed Christ had told him to study aeronautics and electrical engineering, and it was Christ who told him to join the Air Force and fight the godless Chinese communists in Korea. After the war, he settled in Southern California, married Sally, his high school sweetheart, and took a job with McDonnell Douglas. But Elliot was restless from the beginning. He prayed for guidance from the Almighty. After 3 years, he formed his own company, Alatron Defense Systems. Elliot had no desire to build aircraft. He knew planes would always be vital to the nation's defense, but he believed God had granted him a glimpse of the future, and the future belonged to the ballistic missiles, God's arrows, as he called them. Elliot did not build the missiles themselves. He developed and manufactured the sophisticated guidance systems that told them where to strike. 10 years after forming Alatron, Mitchell Elliot was one of the wealthiest men in America, and one of its most influential as well. He had been a confidant of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. He had been on a first-name basis with every Secretary of Defense since Robert McNamara. He could reach half the members of the Senate by telephone in a matter of minutes. Mitchell Elliot was one of the most powerful men in Washington, and yet he operated permanently in its shadows. Few Americans knew what he did, or even knew his name. Sally had died of breast cancer 10 years earlier, and the heady days of big defense spending were long gone. The industry had been devastated, thousands of workers laid off, the entire California economy thrown into turmoil. More important, Elliot believed America was weaker today than she had been in years. The world was a dangerous place. Saddam Hussein had proven that. So had a terrorist armed with a single Stinger missile. Elliot wanted to protect his country. If a terrorist could shoot down a jetliner and kill 200 people, why couldn't a rogue state like North Korea or Libya or Iran kill 2 million people by firing a nuclear missile against New York or Los Angeles? The civilized world had placed its faith in treaties and ballistic missile control regimes. Mitchell Elliot reserved faith for the Almighty, and he did not believe in promises written on paper. He believed in machines. He believed the only way to protect the nation from exotic weapons was with more exotic weapons. Tonight, he had to make his case to the president. Elliot's relationship with James Beckwith had been cemented by years of steady financial support and wise counsel. Elliot had never once asked for a favor, even when Beckwith became a powerful force on the Armed Services Committee during his second term in the Senate. That was all about to change. One of his aides knocked gently at the door. His phalanx of aides was drawn from the ranks of the Special Forces. Mark Callahan was like all the others. He was 6 feet in height, tall enough to be imposing, but not so tall as to dwarf Elliot. Short, dark hair, dark eyes, clean-shaven, dark suit and tie. Each carried a .45 automatic at all times. Elliot had made many enemies along with his millions, and he never set foot in public without protection. "The car is here, Mr. Elliot. I'll be down in a minute." The aide nodded and silently withdrew. Elliot drifted closer to the fire and finished the last of his whiskey. He didn't like being sent for. He would leave when he was ready to leave, not when Paul Vandenberg told him. Vandenberg would still be selling life insurance if it weren't for Elliot. And as for Beckwith, he would have been an unknown San Francisco lawyer, living in Redwood City instead of the White House. They both could wait. Elliot walked slowly to the bar and poured another half inch of whiskey into the glass. He went back to the fire and knelt before it, head bowed, eyes closed. He prayed for forgiveness. Forgiveness for what he had done and for what he was about to do. "We are your chosen people," he murmured. "I am your instrument. Grant me the strength to do your will, and greatness shall be yours." Susanna Dayton felt like an idiot. Only in movies did reporters sit in parked cars, drinking coffee from a styrofoam cup, conducting surveillance like some private investigator. When she left the office an hour earlier, she had not told her editor where she was going. It was just a hunch, and it might lead to nothing. The last thing she wanted her colleagues to know was that she was tailing Mitchell Elliott like a B-movie sleuth. Rain blurred her view. She flicked a switch on the steering column, and wipers swept away the water. She scrubbed away the moisture on the inside of the windshield with a napkin from the downtown deli where she bought the coffee. The black staff car was still there, engine idling, headlights off. Upstairs, on the second floor of the large house, a single light burned. She sipped the coffee and waited. It was awful, but at least it was hot. Susanna Dayton had been White House correspondent for the Washington Post, the pinnacle of power and prestige in the world of American journalism. But Susanna had loathed the job. She hated filing every day, essentially the same story that 200 other reporters filed. She hated being herded around like cattle by the White House press staff, shouting questions at President Beckwith from rope lines at staged and choreographed events. Her writing took on an edge. Vandenberg complained regularly to top management at the Post. Finally, her editor offered her a new beat, money and politics. Susanna took it without hesitation. The new assignment was her salvation. She was to find out which individuals, organizations, and industries were giving money to which candidates and which parties. Did the contributions have an undue effect on policy or legislation? Were the politicians and the givers playing by the rules? Was the money spent properly? Did anyone break the law? Susanna thrived on the work because she loved making the connections. A Harvard-trained lawyer, she was a thorough and cautious reporter. She applied the rules of evidence to virtually every scrap of information she uncovered. Would it be admissible in a court of law? Is it direct testimony or hearsay? Are there names, dates, and places in the story that can be checked out? Is there corroborating testimony? She preferred documents rather than leaks from anonymous sources, because documents can't change their story. Susanna Dayton had concluded that the nation's system of financing its politics amounted to organized bribery and shakedowns, sanctioned by the federal government. There was a thin line separating legal activity from illegal activity. She saw it as her task to catch lawbreakers and expose them. Her personality suited her perfectly to the work. She hated people who cheated and got away with it. She despised people who cut in line at the supermarket. She went crazy on the freeway when an aggressive driver cut into her lane. She loathed people who took shortcuts at the expense of others. Her job was to make sure they didn't get away with it. 2 months earlier, Susanna's editor had given her a tough assignment. Chronicle the long-time relationship, financial and personal, between President James Beckwith and Mitchell Elliott, the chairman of Alitron Defense Systems. Reporters use a cliché when an individual or a group is elusive and hard to trace: shadowy. If anyone had earned the description of shadowy, it was Mitchell Elliott. He had given millions of dollars to the Republican Party over the years, and a watchdog group had told her that he had funneled millions more to the party through questionable or downright illegal means. The main beneficiary of Elliott's generosity was James Beckwith. Elliott had contributed thousands of dollars to Beckwith's campaigns and political action committees over the years, and he had served as a close confidential advisor. One of Elliott's former executives, Paul Vandenberg, was the White House chief of staff. Beckwith regularly stayed at Elliott's vacation homes in Maui and Vail. Susanna had two primary questions. Had Mitchell Elliott made illegal contributions to James Beckwith and the Republican Party over the years? And did he exercise undue influence over the president? At this point, she had answers to neither question. Her editor wanted to publish the piece 2 weeks from now in a special section on President Beckwith and his first term. She had a good deal of work to do before it would be ready to go. Even then, Susanna knew she could do little more than raise questions about Elliott and his ties to the White House. Mitchell Elliott had covered his tracks well. He was completely inaccessible. The Post photo library had just one 10-year-old picture of him, and Alitron Defense Systems didn't even have a spokesman. When she requested an interview, the man at the other end of the line chuckled mildly and said, "Mr. Elliott does not make it a habit to talk to reporters." A source at National Airport told her Elliott had come to Washington earlier that day aboard his private jet. Congress had adjourned, and most members had gone home to campaign. The president had cut short a campaign trip to deal with the downing of Flight 002. Susanna wondered what brought Elliott to town now. That explained why she was sitting outside his Colorama mansion in the rain. The front door of the mansion opened, and two figures appeared: a tall man holding an umbrella, and a shorter, silver-haired man, Mitchell Elliott. The taller man helped Elliott into the back of the car, then walked around and climbed in the other side. The headlights came on, illuminating the street. The car pulled swiftly away from the curb, heading toward Massachusetts Avenue. Susanna Dayton started the engine of her small Toyota and followed, keeping to a safe distance. The large black car moved quickly eastward on Massachusetts along Embassy Row. At DuPont Circle, it melted into traffic in the outer lane and turned south on Connecticut Avenue. It was early yet, but Connecticut Avenue was nearly deserted. Susanna noticed that a strange quiet had descended over the city in the 48 hours since the jetliner had been shot down. The sidewalks were empty, just a few drunks spilling from a tavern south of the circle, and a knot of office workers rushing through the rain into the Farragut North Metro station. She followed the car across K Street as Connecticut turned to 17th Street. She crossed Pennsylvania Avenue and swept past the ornate, brightly lit facade of the old executive office building. Susanna thought she knew where Elliott was dining tonight. The car made a series of left turns and 2 minutes later stopped at the south gate of the White House grounds. A uniformed Secret Service agent stepped forward, peered into the back of the sedan, and ordered the driver to proceed. Susanna Dayton kept driving. She needed the place to wait. Sitting in a parked car for any length of time around the White House was not a good idea these days. The Secret Service had tightened security after a series of attacks on the mansion. She might be approached and questioned. A report might be taken. She parked on 17th Street. There was a small cafe across the street from the old EOB that stayed open late. She grabbed her bag, bulging with newspapers, magazines, and her laptop, and got out. She hurried across the street through the rain and ducked into the cafe. The place was empty. She ordered a tuna sandwich and a cup of coffee, and made a place for herself at a window table while she waited. She pulled the laptop from her bag, adjusted the screen, and turned on the power. Then she inserted a disk into the floppy drive and opened a file. When it came onto the screen, the file appeared as a meaningless series of letters and characters. Susanna was cautious by nature. Many of her colleagues preferred the word paranoid. And she used encryption software to protect all her sensitive files. She typed a 7-letter code name, and the file came to life. The sandwich and coffee arrived. She scrolled down through the file. Names, dates, places, amounts. Everything she knew about the elusive Mitchell Elliott and his links to President Beckwith. She added the events of this evening to the file. Then she shut down the computer and settled in for a long wait. Chapter 5. London. The facts arrived in the Times newsroom shortly after midnight. It remained on the machine untouched for nearly 20 minutes until a young assistant bothered to retrieve it. The assistant read it quickly once and took it to the night editor, Niles Ferguson. A 30-year veteran, Ferguson had seen many faxes like it before, from the IRA, the PLO, Islamic Jihad, and the crazies who simply claim responsibility anytime someone dies violently. This one didn't look like the work of a lunatic. Ferguson had a special telephone number for situations like these. He punched it and waited. A woman's voice answered, pleasant, faintly erotic. "This is Niles Ferguson, The Times. I just received a rather interesting fax in our newsroom. I'm no expert, but it looks authentic. Perhaps you should have a look." Ferguson made a copy of the fax and kept the original for himself. He personally carried it downstairs to the lobby and waited. 5 minutes later, the car arrived. A young man with pockmarked skin and a cigarette between his lips came into the lobby and took possession of the fax. Niles Ferguson went back upstairs. The man with the pockmarked face worked for Britain's Security Service, better known as MI5, which is responsible for counterintelligence, internal subversion, and counterterrorism within the British Isles. He hand-carried the copy of the fax to MI5's glass and steel headquarters overlooking the Thames and presented it to the senior duty officer. The duty officer quickly made 2 calls. The first was reluctantly placed to his counterpart at the Secret Intelligence Service, better known as MI6, which is responsible for gathering intelligence overseas, and therefore considers itself the more glamorous and significant of the 2 services. The second call was to MI5's liaison officer at the CIA's generously staffed London station, located across town within the U.S. Embassy complex at Grosvenor Square. Within 2 minutes, a copy of the letter was sent to Grosvenor Square by secure fax. 10 minutes later, a typist had entered it into the computer system and forwarded it to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. The agency's computer system automatically distributes cables based on keywords and classification. The cable from London went to the offices of the director, the deputy directors for intelligence and operations, the executive director, and the duty officer on the Middle East desk. It was also routed directly to the agency's counterterrorism center. Seconds later, it appeared on the computer screen of the officer assigned to the Islamic extremist group called the Sword of Gaza. The officer's name was Michael Osborne. Chapter 6. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia. Headquarters, Michael Osborne's father always said, was the place good field men went to wither and die. His father had been a case officer in the Soviet directorate. He had recruited and run agents from Moscow to Rome to the Philippines. James Angleton, the famed CIA counterintelligence officer who engaged in a destructive mole hunt for 20 years, ruined his career, the same way he ruined the careers of hundreds of other loyal officers. He spent his final years writing useless assessments and shuffling paper, and he left the agency bitter and disillusioned. 3 years after retirement, he died of cancer. Michael's return to headquarters was as reluctant as his father's, but brought on by different circumstances. The opposition knew his true name and occupation, and it was no longer safe for him to operate undercover in the field. He accepted his fate rather like a model prisoner takes to a life sentence. Still, he never forgot his father's admonition about the perils of life at Langley. They worked together in a single room, known affectionately as the bullpen, on corridor F of the sixth floor. It looked more like the newsroom of a failing Metropolitan daily than the nerve center of the CIA's counterterrorism operation. There was Allen, a bookish FBI accountant who tracked the secret flow of illicit money through the world's most discreet and dirty banks. There was Cynthia, a flaxen angel of British birth who knew more about the IRA than anyone else on Earth. Her cramped cubicle was hung with brooding photographs of Irish guerrillas, including the boy who blew off her brother's hand with a pipe bomb. She gazed at them throughout the day, the way a girl might stare at a poster of the latest teen heartthrob. There was Stephen, alias Eurotrash, whose task was to monitor the various terrorist and nationalist movements of Western Europe. And there was Blaze, a 6'4" gringo from New Mexico, who spoke Spanish, Portuguese, and at least 10 Indian dialects. Blaze focused on the guerrillas and terrorists of Central and South America. He dressed like his targets, in sandals and loose-fitting Indian garb, despite repeated written warnings from personnel. He considered himself the modern equivalent of the samurai, a true warrior poet, and he practiced martial arts with Cynthia when the work was slow. Michael sat in the corner next to Gigabyte, a flaking, pimply boy of 22 who surfed the internet all day, searching the ether world for terrorist communication. Alternative rock music blared from his headphones, and Michael had seen things on his screen that awakened him in the middle of the night. He erected a barrier of old files to shield the view, but when Gigabyte snickered, or when his rock music grew suddenly louder, Michael knew it was best to close his eyes and place his head face down on the desk. The wall clock hung next to a 3-foot cardboard gunman in silhouette, stamped with a circular red international symbol for no. It was nearly 8 p.m., and Michael had been working since 5 that morning. The bullpen was far from deserted. Peru's shining path had kidnapped a government minister, and Blaze was pacing, working the telephones. France's direct action had bombed a Paris metro station. Eurotrash was hunched over his computer terminal, reading message traffic. The IRA had murdered a Protestant developer in front of his wife and children. Cynthia was on the secure line to London, feeding intelligence to Britain's MI5. Thankfully, Gigabyte had gone to a nightclub with a group of friends who believed he created websites for a living. Michael had 15 minutes before he briefed the executive director on developments in the case. The claim of responsibility for the attack on the jetliner had been forwarded to Langley an hour ago. Michael read it for the fifth time. He reviewed the preliminary forensic studies performed by the FBI lab on the Boston Whaler, found adrift off Long Island that morning. He studied the photographs of the corpse found on the boat. 10 minutes left. He could run downstairs to the swill pit and grab a bite to eat, or he could telephone Elizabeth. He had missed her appointment at Georgetown, and he knew they would very likely quarrel. It was not a conversation he wanted to conduct on an agency telephone. He shut down his computer and stepped out of the bullpen. The corridor was starkly lit and quiet. The agency's Fine Arts Commission had tried to brighten the hallway with a display of Indonesian folk art, but it was still as cold and sterile as intensive care. He followed the corridor to a bank of large elevators, took one down to the basement, then followed another anonymous hall to the swill pit. It was late, the selection worse than usual. Michael ordered a fish sandwich and French fries from the bleary-eyed woman behind the counter. She punched at the cash register as if she wanted to do it harm, snatched Michael's money, and gave him the change. Michael ate while he walked. It was dreadful, cold, cooked hours earlier, but it was better than yet another bag of chips. He finished half the sandwich and a few of the fries, and tossed the rest in the trash can. He glanced at his watch. 5 minutes. Enough time for a cigarette. He took the elevator up one level, then walked through a glass doorway giving onto a large center courtyard. William Webster had outlawed smoking inside the building. Those still afflicted with the habit were forced to huddle like refugees in the courtyard or around the exits. After years of working undercover in Europe and the Middle East, cigarettes and smoking had become part of his tradecraft. Michael was unable and unwilling to give them up just because he was now at headquarters. Dead leaves swirled across the expanse of the courtyard. Michael turned his back to the wind and lit a cigarette. It was cold and very dark. The only light came from the glow of office windows above him, tinted green by soundproof glass. In the old days, his office was the back streets of Berlin or Athens or Rome. He was still more comfortable in the Cairo coffee house than Starbucks in Georgetown. He glanced quickly at his watch. Another relaxing dinner. He stuffed his cigarette into a sand-filled ashtray and went inside. The briefing room was directly across the hall from the bullpen. Small, cramped, most of it consumed by a large rectangular table of cheap government-issue wood. On one wall hung the emblems of every government agency with a roll in the center. On the wall opposite the doorway was a projection screen. Michael arrived at precisely 11:45 p.m. He was straightening his tie when two men entered the room. The first was Adrian Carter, the director of the Counterterrorism Center and an operations veteran of 20 years. He was small and pale, with sparse gray hair and bags beneath his eyes that gave him the appearance of perpetual boredom. Michael and Carter had a professional and personal friendship dating back 15 years. The second was Eric McManus, the center's deputy director. McManus was big and bluff, with an easy smile, a thick head of ginger gray hair, and a trace of South Boston in his voice. He was FBI, and looked it. Navy blue suit, crisp white shirt, red tie. When Michael's father worked for the agency, an FBI man in such a senior role would be considered heresy. CIA officers of the old school thought FBI agents could fit everything they knew about intelligence on the backs of their gold shields. That was not the case with McManus, a Harvard-trained lawyer who worked in FBI counterintelligence for 20 years before his assignment to the center. Monica Tyler, as was her habit, entered the room last and precisely 5 minutes late. She regarded her time as priceless, never to be wasted by others. A pair of identical male factotums trailed softly after her, each fervently clutching a leather-bound briefing book. Except for personnel, no one within the agency claimed to know who they were or who had spawned them. The office wits said they were conveyed with Monica from her Wall Street investment firm, along with her private bathroom and mahogany office furniture. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.